Hello, and welcome to the Olympic and Bundy podcast. I'm Kelly Taylor. It's 2018, and the Golden State is green. California now has dispensaries selling legal marijuana. There are some that open January 1st, some that may not open for a few months, some local governments that have opted out and won't open any for the next, foreseeable future. There are new laws in place, new regulations. There's a lot going on. So if you're curious about what's happening in California with marijuana, whether you're a regular user yourself or want to know what's changed with new laws and regulations, this episode is for you. Or perhaps you've never smoked or consumed cannabis a day in your life, but you're curious. This episode is also for you. Two people who have been working to educate others about cannabis and really change the public perception about people who use it are Candace Hawes. She's the founder of the Orange County chapter of Normal, which is an organization that nationwide that works to reform marijuana laws, and Stefan Borst-Sensulo. He's an attorney who's worked a lot in cannabis legislation, lobbying. He's worked as a criminal defense attorney. I learned a lot from both of them about what's led up to this point and what's next for cannabis in California, because even though Proposition 64 passed, it's ever evolving. And they're both parents to young kids. They talked about how they plan to discuss the topic of pot with their kids because it's still illegal federally, but it's legal here within the state that these kids live in. So, it's confusing. How do you explain that to a kid, especially, maybe these parents are used to talking about it and their kids will grow up knowing about cannabis, but, maybe not all of their friends' parents will agree. So, just the whole topic of how do you talk about this with your kids in a good way. So enjoy.
From the Fox 11 studios in Los Angeles, California, it's the Olympic and Bundy podcast with host Kelly Taylor.
So I want to start with you, Candace. Your title is executive director of the Orange County chapter of Normal, right?
Yes,
correct. You're the founder of it.
Yes, founded that chapter 15 years ago.
Wow. So this is your 15 year anniversary.
July will be, yes.
Congratulations. That's
Thank
awesome.
Thank you.
In the acronym, it's an acronym, NORMAL, which is National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws.
Yes.
Got it. First of all, with NORMAL, what would you say is the main mission of NORMAL?
Well, the main mission of NORMAL is to educate people about cannabis and to change the perception of the public about people that use cannabis. It was initially started because Keith Strope, a lawyer in Washington, D.C., thought, there's no one really looking out for the cannabis consumers, to change the perception and to fight for our rights. So that's basically how NORMAL started. They were the first ever marijuana nonprofit reform organization founded in 1970, actually by a donation by the Playboy Foundation.
Really? Yes. By Hef?
Yes, because he's actually an advocate of the First Amendment, if you think about it, NORMAL and talking about, your belief that a certain law is not, right, is part of the First Amendment.
1970, was that before Nixon?
It was during the Carter administration, right?
Well, yeah, Nixon would have been 70, so...
right at the cusp,
yeah,
then.
It was right in the midst of his kind of, terrible second term. Yeah. So.
Gotcha. And that, because Nixon was the one who implemented Schedule mm-hmm. One, different classifications for drugs. And so I'm assuming maybe that could have helped.
Yeah, exactly.
NORMAL.
And they were doing the spraying of the Paraquat in the marijuana field. So that was one of the first issues that NORMAL took up, working with the White House and the drug czar to try to stop that.
Oh, yeah. Gotcha. So your background, I was reading that was there an incident that kind of triggered?
Yeah, I was 21 years old. I was on a vacation from school and I went to Vegas to blow off some steam. And unfortunately, I came into a situation with a friend where he was going to be arrested and they were going to let me go. But they're like, we're just going to search your bag first. We're going to let you go. So they grabbed my bag. And back then, I was straight from Colorado. I was Mormon. I was very obedient, and I didn't know that you could say no. And so unfortunately, the officer searched my bag. He found back then, you could still get low quality brick weed, for $25 an ounce.
Yeah.
So it was minuscule, you know, but it was over an ounce. And so, you know, they threw me in jail and they took away my car. And most of all, they laughed about the fact that it was going to ruin my whole future. I was no longer going to be able to take the bar, that I was going to lose my financial aid for having a drug conviction. And I just really felt like that was wrong, you know, that this was going to affect me for the rest of my life. Something so small as just, you know, smoking marijuana, when I saw a lot of people my whole life doing things that were worse. And this, you know, I felt was the thing that made me feel okay. And so, you know, I just put the word out there, and there are people all over that want to get involved. They're just looking for somebody to kind of take that first step. And that's how our chapter started 15 years ago. And since then, it's just been getting bigger and bigger and stronger.
And were you, are you originally from Orange County?
I'm from Colorado.
Oh, sorry.
And then I moved to Orange County to go to college. And that's when this all happened.
Gotcha. And that's what led you to, that's how you found Normal.
Yeah. After I got back home, I went on the internet and I was like, you know, trying to research groups that I can get involved with to try to change the laws so that this didn't happen to anybody else. And I found Normal and I reached out to them, and they were immediately responsive and they invited me to come down to their conference, and it just opened my eyes. It was amazing seeing like doctors and lawyers and politicians and celebrities. Woody Harrelson was there at that conference, and it was like, this is amazing, you know. I really felt like I found my place. And, you know, like I said before, I came back to Orange County, and it was just, you know, inspiring to see how many people also felt the same way and who wanted to get behind a 21-year-old, you know, at that time.
Definitely. I'm sure that was like kind of empowering.
Yeah. It's I got to do amazing things like go to the White House and speak in front of members of Congress and all sorts of things I wouldn't have ever been able to do without, you know, getting active.
You mentioned, so you're originally from Colorado and your family's Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
Just out of curiosity, what was your experience before going to college in that situation? Like, what was your experience with marijuana? Were you, did your family ever talk about it? Did anyone use it? Did kids at school use it? You know, like, what was your...
My parents used it, but we didn't even know. Now I know as an adult that they were, you know. But, you know, me and my brothers were always really responsible. We, you know, had our fun as teenagers, but we always got really good grades. So, you know, it wasn't something that brought me down in my life. So it wasn't really a problem at home.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. That's funny. I know so many people who, same situation. They didn't realize that their parents used any type of cannabis. And now they're like, oh.
That was really funny.
Oh, wait, hold on. What? Really? Oh. Gotcha. Okay. So, wow. So this must have been like from 2003 to now, that's like a roller coaster.
Yeah. I mean. And it has really been a roller coaster in this industry. I mean, it's gone from us. Our main duty was showing up at raids where the DEA was there taking patients out in handcuffs and their medicine and throwing it in trucks. That's what we used to do. Nowadays, we're lobbying local governments and we're collecting signatures to change the law and educating people about, you know, go low, go slow in this new recreational climate. So it's really a change. It's been a roller coaster ride.
Go low, go slow. Hold on to that. I want to talk about that. So, Stefan, I was reading, so you've worked as like a criminal defense attorney, lobbyist, writer, you do some writing. Mm-hmm. I feel like you've done a lot of stuff. Specifically, if you're an attorney, I feel like you could focus on 1 million parts of the law. There's a million different areas. What led you specifically to, say, cannabis legislation?
So originally when I was in law school, I got very bored in 2012 doing child dependency law as a clerk. And it's not bored in the sense that, you know, it's not an exciting thing, but at the same time, a high burnout rate for people who are defending parents who are, especially very poor parents who are facing getting their kids taken away.
Yeah.
So I started getting more involved in local politics in Long Beach. I worked as an opposition researcher for the Alan Lowenthal campaign, and then kind of transitioned as I was leaving law school into working for now the person who's now the mayor of Long Beach. And so I got a really good kind of view as to what was happening locally within my particular city. Parallel to that, I was never much of a smoker until I got into law school and figured out it was like the one drug that, versus alcohol, that I could take and enjoy, and then it wouldn't screw me up for grades.
Yeah.
And I could wake up on a Saturday morning and read cases.
Wouldn't be hungover.
Exactly.
Yeah. Law school has so much reading, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a 6-day-a-week job for a very long time. And then by the time I was actually working for the city, though, this was in 2013, it was in the midst of our own kind of failed attempt at first regulating the business. And I unfortunately presided over and was trying to give advice to Robert Garcia at the time that he ultimately was the deciding vote to get rid of the nascent cannabis industry within the city of Long Beach, which, as a massive stoner working on the 14th floor at City Hall was very dispiriting. So I quietly started. My idea was really just, you know, hey, you know, you want to regulate these things, you want to control public problem, you know, public opinion, do what we did for any other industry and slap a minimum wage ordinance onto it. You know, the people who are willing to comply and willing to pay their workers a living wage, they'll be the only ones to survive this new regulated market. But the city manager and city attorney disagreed with me, and that was the seemingly end of the industry in my city for a while.
And what year was that?
That would have been 2014.
And they're just finally now getting their chance to open, right?
Exactly. So I burned my way. That was the beginning of my kind of the slow descent into, you know, not being able to keep my mouth shut with controversial issues. And the Long Beach Police Department in particular had a really bad habit at the time of shooting unarmed people. So I started speaking out about that, and that was the end of my tenure working within the city of Long Beach. So I found myself kind of as a, you know, more or less burn noticed for working within any part of the political sphere there. Started running my mouth off about, you know, this and that, and then, but I really needed to find some way of, you know, constraining that kind of activist energy within a way that also paid, because I noticed a lot more of the, you know, left-leaning activist types within the city. You work for housing, but you yourself are only going to be making, you know, $20,000 a year. So you, while it's very effective to be empathetic with the people that you're helping out, you also, you know, I need to pay for my law school bills.
Right.
So finding a well-funded kind of social justice-oriented activity was a prerequisite, and started coming to OC Normal meetings and finding out that Santa Ana was maybe a year ahead of all the shenanigans that we were now experiencing within the city of Long Beach. And Candace in particular kind of laid down and blazed a path about how independent, actively involved citizen initiatives could overwhelm, you know, what otherwise would be a very, very corrupt local government system in terms of deciding where these uniquely regulated businesses would exist, if at all. So working with her and finding and using kind of the Santa Ana work as a template, jump back in without even a client in terms of just kind of agitating and doing local organizing. Worked alongside the Long Beach Collective Association. I had my own private clients at the same time, and worked to defeat a really bad peril initiative that was coming up in the city to kind of co-opt some of the businesses without really solving the issue over regulation. We defeated that and then put on our own ballot initiative in 2016, which won overwhelmingly.
In the city of Long Beach.
In the city of Long Beach, passed at the same time as Proposition 64. And, you know, a year later, we're now bearing fruit. We're going to have a maximum of 32 dispensaries, all of which are going to be operating under a labor peace agreement with pursuant to the UFCW, probably, and unlimited commercial activities for non-retail parts of the sector.
Nice.
Wow. So this is the number one. This is the most confusing thing to me, and really is why I reached out to Normal. When you say that it was simultaneous while Prop 64 passed. Mm-hmm. I think to just someone who's not involved in this, they would say, well, I thought Prop 64 passed, so why do you have to pass something?
Exactly.
Why is Long Beach on its own? Can you guys talk a little bit about that?
Well, the way I like to describe it is the way that would solve this, especially if you're a believer like myself, as somebody who believes that the federal government should have, in the Supremacy Clause, should govern over you know, and that states' rights is usually the hobgoblin of really, really bad ideas. So residing in that as your justification for and your ability to be in your reasoning for being able to exist, it makes me uncomfortable. But the federal government could solve this by recognizing that, frankly, the scheduling of cannabis is currently without any sort of merit, was explicitly racist and violates equal protection. But because they don't want to go ahead and admit that, or the Supreme Court doesn't want to overturn Gonzales v. Raich, we're stuck with this really silly idea where the federal government is enforcing something that's vastly unpopular, and including states that it doesn't really have a lot of, you know, direct power over or leverage. So they kicked the can down, and the Obama administration was probably the best at doing this and saying with the Cole memo, look, we can't legislatively change this right now because of a lot of different reasons, but as long as you abide by these certain characteristics, you're not going to be an enforcement priority for us. You know, we're working, we'll allow the DA to run roughshod over places where they are allowed to go, but, you know, as long as you're not engaging in interstate commerce, and you're not diverting, and you're having some sort of protection for youth, as well as a couple other characteristics, we're not going to bust you.
So meaning, leave it to the states.
Leave it to the
do
states.
Do your own thing. Don't go in between
if
states.
If you're, you know, really controlling a regulated market, if you're not just letting everybody do whatever they want, then they're going to put you on the lower end of the the priorities.
Gotcha. And then on top of that, I mean, separate to that or in parallel to that, the Warback Reform Amendment, you know, explicitly defunds the feds from being able to do that within states where they are in strict compliance with this particular memo.
Yeah.
Now that said, that's essentially the federal government kicking it down to the states. The states are looking at this and saying, boy, this is a real big problem. You know, it's a complicated thing with a bunch of conflicts having to do with usual kind of things that will be handled by the federal government, you know, when it comes to consumer protections, banking, well, you know, those sort of things are usually within the jurisdiction for the feds for figuring out. And now we're being forced to do it. Great. So they say, well, let's pick the parts that are really with it, that we have the capability of either funding through directly through taxation, or that we have that fit within the traditional parameters of state government, or that we kind of, because in the case of California, we're big enough so that we can kind of create analogous state level functions for doing that. But, you know, both from a practical standpoint in terms of they don't want to deal with it, also, and the political issue of, well, we don't want to force this on localities that don't want it. The states had land use issues. Anything having to do with land use kicked down to the localities. They're kind of in a Colorado model. So if you go to Colorado, Denver has a bunch of dispensaries, but Colorado Springs, where focus on the family and the Air Force are, no dispensaries.
None.
And they wanted to preserve that here in California because there are certain localities, you know, in you and I both know them, that we'll never, ever decide to have commercial cannabis.
Like Kern County. Isn't Kern County one?
Kern County, you know.
Or maybe they could change.
Kern County could be changing purely because this is where...
Some of the cities within Kern County, maybe not the whole county, but the cities within. And so that's what Stefan is trying to say, too, here, is that we still need to pass local initiatives because Prop 64 set up a state regulatory system, but you still have to have local authority or a compliance.
They allowed every single locality to opt out. And so back in 2015, after the MCRSA passed, we were to that beginning of 2016, we had something called Banapalooza. So the first 3 months of 2016, all of us were looking and being, you know, while we were celebrating the first state regulated aspect of that point, it was just medical. We're looking and we're like, oh my God, 90% of the state is.
Yeah. Every city just ban. And there were so many that we couldn't make it to all the city council meetings
No, yeah, we don't want this.
As soon as the regulations came out,
60 jurisdictions on the same Tuesday are banning.
Yeah. Cause the state said, we're going to set up this regulatory system. We're going to give licenses, but you have to license them first. So these cities said, no, we don't want to do that. So they went and
out of curiosity, from your guys' experience working in these places, what was the main reason that they didn't want to?
It's laziness. I mean, the League of California Cities is a very powerful lobbying organization and has some of the best attorneys having to do with land use in the entire state. So the idea that they couldn't draw up a model ordinance that they would distribute to all their partners overnight is absurd. Instead, what happened is a lot of politicians said, oh boy, you know, and this again comes to the issue of shifting responsibilities. They said, this is a very complicated thing. A lot of city councils, especially throughout the state, are part-time, so these aren't professional politicians with a huge legislative staff to go through the details. And they said, we don't want to deal with this. Yeah. We'll ban it. We'll make the city manager come back in a year or two. Yeah. You know, stoners can wait. And what they found, what ended up happening is that finally, what had been a very, very localized thing, and a lot of people not wanting to come out of the cannabis closet, bonded together and started to become local activists for the first time in their career. So we finally started developing action plans, you know, in every single individual cities, actually kind of stemming from that BanWatch Facebook group, became very influential overnight and now is, you know, this formidable force of a couple.
And the BanWatch Facebook group was basically people who were paying attention to who didn't want it and wanted to go there and do like kind of a grassroots effort to change minds.
So now, you know, whenever something's happening in Long Beach, for example, people know, it's like, oh yeah, Stefan lives there, you know, ask him what's going on. And, you know, I'll be the kind of almost designated person to sit in through the city council meeting that night to say, this is what's actually happening. Don't worry about what the news got this wrong. This is where we're succeeding. This is where we're really failing. Yeah. So it provided that good objective kind of source of information for people.
And like he said, the city councils are very overwhelmed and they rely a lot on the direction that the League of Cities gives them, which is controlled by one main law firm here in California, which is Best, Best, and Krieger. So, I mean, they're just waiting on their their direction. And for a lot of years, Best Best and Krieger really told them not to go forward because they're hearing from a lot of people in the cities that say, you know, oh, I support marijuana, medical marijuana, but I don't want it in my city. So it's the NIMBY problem. You know, that I think is what fed the League of Cities to give this bad direction, but it's changing now.
And it was a complicated thing for cities as well. I feel like the best, I like telling the story because it's a good, because it illustrates how complicated this, back in 2013, when I worked for the city of Long Beach, I quietly went up during a, you know, raucous Democratic drunken party in Christmas, and I asked Councilman Al Austin, whose wife actually is a works for Reggie Jones Sawyer, who's now one of the biggest co-sponsors of cannabis legislation. And I asked him, I said, Al, you know, this is absurd. Why do we get rid of all the dispensaries? We can, you know, we regulate all sorts of very problematic industries, especially from an environmental standpoint.
In Long Beach,
From Long Beach, why can't we put down these rules? And he said, Stephen, it's an issue of we as a city are being asked to do things that we don't have the funds or the capabilities to be able to do. Gotcha. A city cannot act as the FDA, you know, and that's what you're being. It can't act as a consumer protection agency. It doesn't have the resources to do that. So once the state, what was supposed to happen is once the state puts down certain regulations, they can adopt that into the municipal code, and the cities can actually focus on the things that they have that are traditionally within their legal jurisdiction to be able to handle. And that's only been happening within the last couple of years. One, it kind of, as it folded out with the states having, you know, their baseline rules, the localities feel a little bit, you know, more comfortable.
More at ease, especially seeing now their neighboring cities that are doing really well with the legalization. Santa Ana, as Stefan talked about, Normal started a PAC, and we went around and collected funds from the dispensaries in Santa Ana. We collected over $200,000, collected 13,000 signatures, and got it on the ballot. That's what eventually, you know.
So basically, when we hear that Santa Ana on New Year's Day already is a place where you can go and buy adult use cannabis, that was a result of a lot of people making that effort.
Yeah, and I mean, the city was not behind it in the beginning. The city didn't even want medical marijuana. The city was very against my measure, and they only put their own measure up against when it was polling really well. So it's funny now to see a city that was very conservative. Now they're saying, not only do we want 20 medical marijuana licenses, we're going to give 30 recreational ones, and we're going to look at commercial uses. So it's funny to see how far a city can come in like 5 years from saying, not in my backyard, to please bring the money.
Come on over here.
You know, and you may have seen it all over the news. I mean, there was like at least five locations in Santa Ana that had their go ahead for January 1st at the opening. And there was thousands of people there. In LA, they've been having a little bit of a bottleneck.
Because West Hollywood, I know, was yesterday, some places open.
Well, one of the truisms about, you know, just the entire cannabis political movement here is that I think it's more of an outgrowth of the gay rights movement. So the entire reason that 215 exists, and then I'll get to why this applies to WeHo, but the entire reason that 215 exists is because of the HIV/AIDS in the 90s and being just horrendous. So people...
And hold on, for a newbie here, what is 215?
Proposition 215 was the measure that originally allowed for medical marijuana.
In 1996.
Gotcha.
So once that was passed, you know, the few localities that actually took it up and allowed for some sort of transparent commercial transactions regarding cannabis were West Hollywood, Palm Springs, and then a little bit later on, Long Beach.
Yeah, from the get-go,
we had large gay populations with gay politicians who understood the need that medicine doesn't always need to be something that's single purpose and in a pill.
Yeah. And really, the first medical marijuana protection was meant for those suffering from HIV, AIDS, and cancer, the most serious conditions. And the main proponents behind the original medical marijuana measure were sick and dying patients with HIV, Dennis Perone being one of them.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I didn't know that.
So people like John Heilman, you know, even back before the HIV, AIDS epidemic with, you know, Harvey Milk was an early proponent for legalization. I mean, it's for whatever reason, you know, even if it's just the fact that it's a, you know, the wherever you see large organized gay populations, you're going to find legal cannabis very soon.
Wow. So 22 years, 96 to now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, just in terms of if you're thinking about it and working in this industry every day, I mean, ages.
People in the city of LA were complaining about having to shut down for 3 months as a means for having their provisional licenses awarded. And I was like, you know, they shut down at 5 years for Long Beach because Long Beach had a lottery where they literally chose the bottle. If you look it up, the city clerk, the machine, the lottery balls for choosing who the legal dispensaries were going to be broke. So they had to pick the balls out of a trash can. And then they were going through, and all those people went through all the problems with planning, with fire department, all environmental review, all that sort of things. And the second before they were allowed to use permit, the Riverside decision came down, from which was allowed for cities to ban it. So the city just decided, you know what, we're going to ban everything.
Yeah.
And so those guys who had spent, and people who had spent all this money trying to build up their industries, overnight were told, yeah, you can't actually exist. And there's nothing you can do about it.
It's crazy.
Wow.
So they sat on that right for 5 years.
Talk about a slap in the
face. I mean, and there's some people, like I think like the guy from Oz in West Hollywood, he's been in it probably since almost that long. So imagine those guys, people in Long Beach were waiting 5 years. Some people have been waiting like 20 years to finally have a legal license from the city. So as frustrating this is, as people have to shut down for months and they don't have financial plans for that kind of thing. If you think about it, people have been waiting 22 years to be able to say that I, you know, own or part of this legally licensed business that's legitimate now.
Yeah.
You know?
And sure the issue over a license versus limited immunity from a legal standpoint is really important.
What is limited immunity?
Limited immunity is the way that especially the city of LA used to protect these businesses. And what it was saying, look, you have this legal fiction of a cooperative. You know, essentially it's a
Patient helping patients,
so that there's not actually like a traditional corporate structure or corporate veil that can be structured that's being established. Instead, it just happens to be people who under the common purpose of wanting to provide medical cannabis.
So basically, so I'm understanding this right, it's not like there's a Kaiser Permanente for medical cannabis.
Exactly.
It's just basically like
it. Back in the day, it was only cooperatives because it had to be. Under the way that they, in order to achieve that, and what the limited immunity comes in is, that's the state essentially saying, again, as long as you abide by these certain characteristics, you are on our lowest priority for busting. We still can.
Yeah, and you're still a ghost. You still can't go around and put that on like applications for homes or tout that you're a business owner. You're
right.
Still underground. Now, like the licensing is so much.
A license and a permit from a locality gives you a right to be able to defend. So if they take it away, if they decide, you know, we're going to confiscate these things or we're going to shut you down, then you actually have the ability to go into civil court and seek damages for that. Versus, no, you're a lawbreaker. You're the least bad lawbreaker, according to the city of L.A., but you're still somebody who's breaking the law.
Wow, that's huge. So if that's your livelihood,
yeah.
If you're an entrepreneur and you have a business, now you actually have
yeah.
a piece of paper.
Yeah.
I can say, listen, you can't take this away from me. This is
yeah.
This is
I mean, because the most successful dispensary, seeing like 700-800 patients a day, like some of them do in LA, could be shut down and gone the next day. You know, in the past,
up until
yeah. Now in this new industry, things are going to be different.
I want to talk really quickly about terminology, because obviously you can say a million different words for marijuana, cannabis, pot, you know, whatever you use. But I was actually talking with a reporter this week and saying you guys were coming in, and he was like, you know, you should use adult use cannabis.
Yeah.
And I didn't even think about it until he said that. I'm wondering, is there a terminology that you guys prefer and why?
Well, yeah, I like adult use instead of recreational, especially with like older seniors.
Well, a lot of like news outlets use recreational marijuana, I've noticed this week.
Mm-hmm.
And
sexier.
That kind of sounds a little bit. There's something about it. Adult use seems more normal,
mm-hmm.
like just sort of more streamlined too.
Yeah.
Well, it's intentional.
Yeah.
You know, it's part of, a lesson that we learned from the gay rights movement in terms of presentability. So when we're going before, you know, you'll see that cannabis activists especially will make an extra effort nowadays to make sure that they're in suits, that they're speaking eloquently as possible, that, you know, you've taken some breath mints so that the joint that you smoked beforehand isn't that,
yeah.
that obvious. But when it comes to terminology, I mean, adult use is critical to that because it emphasizes that we are not trying to become the new cigarettes. We're not trying to become the new booze.
It's not just about getting like really high, you know, like recreational, like, you know, beer bongs or anything. It's about, you know, as an adult making a decision to do something in the privacy of your own home, you know?
Yeah, like if you want a glass of wine,
maybe
you want to eat an edible, just hanging out. Gotcha. Okay. See, I didn't even know about that term until this week.
Well, marijuana even as a term, I think you can look inside one of the footnotes to Gonzales v. Raich, John Paul Stevens threw into that. Marijuana was a term that was originally used by in California in the early 30s, I want to say. It was a slang term that was
marijuana,
because what they were using was they wanted to enforce racial covenants in their city. They wanted to say basically Mexicans get out, and you can't say that because it would violate equal protection. But you can say, oh, anybody caught using marijuana with the H.
Because historically Mexicans were using marijuana.
They're the only ones, frankly, smoking in the southwest part of the United States. It was not the use of cannabis. in the Eastern Seaboard up until, you know, people frankly who started settling out here was almost unheard of. I mean, it was used in tinctures, and it was strictly for medical purposes. Yeah. People weren't, you know, smoking it. The first people to actually, you know, roll up a joint and in the United States and smoke it were
White people.
Well, they were Mexican residents of California. Yeah. You know, so that it was kind of a distinguishing cultural factor, kind of like my people, the Italians up in the Northeast, you know, and our red wine. So
Gotcha. So maybe the term marijuana kind of has
a derogatory
something connected to it.
And when I have, and frankly, from a point of view from the lobbyist, whenever I have an opponent who is on the city council talking about marijuana this, marijuana that, and it's really easy for me to go up there and say, especially we were talking about the Nixon administration earlier, oh, you want to talk, you're using a racist term from, you know, back in the day. Now, I'm going to say marijuana all the time. But you're using it as a way to be able to keep us down. So I'm going to bring up the entire, you know, history and etymology behind what you're using and use it as a way to shame you.
Yeah. Even the Bureau. I mean, the Bureau of Cannabis Control has gone through three or four different name changes. Yep. One of them, really? The original one was the BMCR, the Bureau of Medical Cannabis Control, the bummer. BMCR. Yeah. And then now it's the Bureau of Cannabis Control. So they have also recognized, you know, that it's incorrect to use the word marijuana and almost in all their regulations, they can refer to it as cannabis now.
Wow. Yeah. The bummer.
Yeah. That was a good running joke for a while because, you know, everyone was not very excited about these regulations and, you know.
Yeah. Bummer. We're losing bummer.
Yeah.
So just for the sake of anyone who's kind of been not necessarily paying attention in general to what's going on right now, this is also a confusing thing because when Prop 64 passed in November 2016, it was, oh, okay, it's legal now. All right, cool. And then my friends out of state throughout 2017 would just be like, oh, so you can just go and to a dispensary and just buy cannabis now.
2016, after the second that Prop 64 passed, I could hand you a joint and not be charged with sales.
Got
it. You know, as long as you didn't
give... You could gift it to somebody.
You can gift it. As long as you didn't give me back anything of in kind, you know, I can hand you, you know, up to an ounce, and you can have up to an ounce on you. Without any having to worry about any sort of arrest, no limited immunity, nothing like that. Just pure, you are immune from arrest.
You were also allowed that same night to possess up to 1 ounce, 8 grams of concentrates, and 6 plants per house. Correct.
Yep.
Those are the parts that went into effect that night. There were other parts being the license sales that weren't due to set. To start until January 1st.
And if you want to think about it, Prop 64 was a really complicated omnibus act as well, because it came with it a Criminal Justice Reform Act that was similar to Proposition 47, as well as, didn't it have some hemp laws included inside of it? So it was a big bill.
Oh, it had hemp laws?
It was like 64 pages. Mm-hmm. And usually there's a single...
single issue.
Single issue law where you can only cover one issue per initiative, but this one...
But it entailed... So basically... The penalties were lessened as part of Prop 64?
Some.
We got rid of felonies. Okay. So, and this is a really, and I love representing clients for this because it's the most fun thing in the world. If you got a felony back in the day for possession of cannabis, you know, happened all the time. You can go in and like 64 under 47, 64 allowed some people to be able to petition the court to have that reduced to a misdemeanor.
So retroactively.
Yeah, exactly. You can have things removed from your record if they would now be legal under the new laws.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that doesn't get talked about
but
as much as...
some of the new penalties that were added is before there was no penalty for smoking cannabis in public. We would tell people, just don't smoke where you can't smoke cigarettes. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, though, there is a fine attached to that. You cannot smoke cannabis in a public place or have an open container. So that means like rolling a joint in your lap or something. It's a $100 fine or $250 if you're doing it within an area where they prohibit smoking cigarettes as well. So that's a new fine. That was something that people cried out about because there's a lot of people that face it. Don't have a home or can't smoke in their home. So a lot of people were smoking in parks or something, you know.
Section 8 housing controlled by the feds.
Yeah. So now we criminalized that, unfortunately.
Okay, so that happened. What about, out of curiosity, could you bring edibles to, say, a movie theater?
Well.
Or a restaurant? Or, you know, like what happens with that?
Okay. So if I'm bringing it to a restaurant, if the restaurant doesn't know about it, hypothetically, and I'm just kind of ingesting on there, I don't think that, you know, they're not going to be you're not going to be in particularly any trouble there. Now, let's say if the restaurant was openly advertising as a kind of bring your own cannabis type of thing, then you're going to be possibly getting into some more trouble with the
local city authorities. Might find them as a nuisance, or you know,
or they might have an existing law that kind of prohibits that. Yeah. They might see that you're making things available, even if you're not explicitly conducting sales. So, you know, it's still within the consumer to be a little bit discreet.
You can bring cannabis with you, though. I would say most places, except for like airports, prisons, courthouses, schools. Places like that, schools, I would still leave it at home.
Yeah, schools have a 600-foot, and that's a federally enforced 600-foot buffer zone for any sort of possession or activity. And
even a college, right?
Oh, yeah. And the only people who have protection for the only people who have protection for that are medical patients. And that's not even explicitly statute. That's under a case law. Because, for example, my house is right across the street from middle school. So I can possess in my house only because I'm a medical patient.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. But if you didn't have a medical card, then you...
He would be within that 600 feet. He lives within 600 feet of a school.
So basically, if you're a neighbor of a school, don't plan to have... I mean...
Absolutely don't plant.
Don't grow.
And, you know, more than likely, you should probably stay in the medical system and have a card.
Yeah, even though we have this new recreational system where you can buy cannabis as an adult anywhere, there are reasons to stay medical. There's many reasons to stay medical. If you get your ID card from the county, you can be exempt from... about 10% of the possibly 35% in taxes you're going to be paying on marijuana.
Right, because there's going to be a jump. What, like 15,
there's
going to
be
sort of a sticker
there's
shock.
There's a 15% marijuana tax that they're putting on it because of Prop 64. And then there's also a state tax, a local tax, and a use tax.
Oh, wow.
And an excise tax. Mm-hmm. So all those, I've not seen a receipt yet, as in the last couple of days, to see how much exactly people are paying in Santa Ana as opposed to like Long Beach or something. But I've been hearing between 27 and 34, depending on where you live in California. And 10% of that is the tax that you could be exempt from if you get your ID card. Also, if you're a parent, it's best to keep your medical marijuana status for that reason. Also, if you live within close distance of a school.
But the problem having the card is that you can't own a gun.
Correct. So there's drawbacks.
Why?
The ATF, one of the ATF forms asks specifically if you are if you use a federally controlled substance and they've...
Well, even if you didn't have a card, wouldn't you have to say yes, even if you're adult use marijuana?
Exactly. But from a criminal defense standpoint, you know, how are they...
There's no way for them to know except for if you have the ID
card.
Unless
you have a card.
And this is something that people ask me, though. But I've never heard of anyone who ever got in trouble from being on that medical marijuana ID card. I've never had anybody say that, hey, I applied for a gun and they cross-checked. I've never heard of anyone ever having anything happen because of getting an ID card. But people always say, oh, but this, oh, but that, you know.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, have you?
I haven't heard of it, but at the same time, especially when dealing with anything with federal jurisdiction, I tend to advise people to be very careful.
And you know, the government can get really any information they really want anyways. So it's like...
True.
Big brother.
Yeah. So if you... After... beginning in 2018, is there a difference to how much you're able to buy in terms of, like, say if you buy edibles, say if you were a regular consumer already, and now in 2018, you want to buy a certain amount of THC in an edible. Is it lessened now? More? Mm-hmm. The same? It's lessened.
Yeah. Now we're down to Colorado standards, which are 100 mg max and 10 milligram
delineated dosage. So you have to be able to tell what 10 milligrams is. And the servings can only be 10 milligrams. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to have a 100 milligram bar, you have to have 10 servings. You know, you can't, you know.
So essentially you probably wind up paying more for, or you can't buy at one time. You have to
as strong of an edible. Yeah. Oh. Also, you know, there's packaging changes. Everything has to be in childproof packaging.
Does that apply? Are medical marijuana patients exempt from that?
No. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's new standards for any commercial cannabis activity, whether it's medical or recreational. Also, too, for the dosages, there's differences between medical and adult. Medical, like tinctures and stuff, can have a max of 2,000 milligrams of THC, and adult is only 1,000. So that's, you know, if people use the tinctures, like the drops under the tongue, there's a difference there, too.
Gotcha.
And then also, when... for 6 months, they're letting patients buy, or people, adult and patients, buy from the same products. But starting July 1st, products are going to either be licensed A for adult or M for medical. So people that are just buying it adult use will only be able to buy from the A products, from the adult licensed products, whereas medical will be able to pick from both. So medical people will have more of a selection as well.
So basically what you're saying is keep a medical card or
yeah, get, or, exactly.
I mean, but if costs, you need one.
It costs about $100 a month. Yeah. So yeah. Or, I'm sorry, $100 a year. So if you are in, you know, if you're somebody who frequently has cannabis on them, if you travel with cannabis only in your trunk, but you still have it, you know, if you're worried about, especially from the parental issue, because dependency and Section 300 petitions are going up all the time against medical marijuana patients, so and users. So having a card on there that says that you've gone through the trouble to be able to get, you know, sanctioned from the state for this particular activity that you're engaged with is a very good idea.
Yeah, that leads me to, I want to talk about the most interesting part of this, too, is that it's, we were sort of talking about earlier how it's illegal federally. And when it comes to, say, banking, there's very limited banking options, it seems like. I mean, do certain businesses have bank accounts? I mean, what typically is, how do they go about all this?
I've seen some Bay Area companies actually get accounts through credit unions, even like public service credit unions, like firefighter credit unions, been able to open accounts. A lot of companies will open management corporations that don't have a cannabis sounding name, open a bank account through that management company and do all business that way. Whether that is completely the best thing to do legally is another, but they have to kind of make do. It's that or hide thousands of dollars in your wall.
The I mean, two big issues are going up there. I mean, one is that they, I'll just talk briefly about like kind of the experience in Colorado that they had with just a sheer amounts of cash. I work with somebody now who was the first, Greg Gamet, who was the first licensee out of Denver. And he has a funny story about showing up, I think, to the Denver city clerk with the amount of money that he had to pay in taxes.
Yeah.
And he's doing it with a duffel bag full of cash.
Yeah.
And they had no, at the time, they had no precautions about like, well, actually, maybe we should, you know, like bring you around back to be able to do this. So that sort of thing is, a, you know, creates a public safety hazard in and of itself.
Yeah, well, I mean, just working around that, I would be nervous. Yeah. But, having that much.
And having to count tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, I mean, that's
in fives, tens,
that's
20s.
Money that you have to pay dedicating time to do that.
But, and actually, the state here, to even fine people 10% for paying in cash. Mm-hmm. So some people were like, well, I won't pay at all then. You know, that's it created that kind of situation. So.
But luckily, we do have really good state leaders on this. John Chang, the state treasurer in particular, has dove into the most complicated issues with banking and has been really, really working hard to be able to find out how to get around this, you know, this particular issue. I know that Herb Wesson out of the city of LA recently talked about doing a publicly owned bank that would be doing for the state.
Amazing.
For the city, because we can charter banks under California, apparently. You know, with regards to how these companies kind of survive in this area, though, without banking, you're not going to get, I'll put it this way, even the lawyers are now getting targeted. I'm forgetting his last name, but Khursheed, who is one of the main lawyers for the California Cannabis Industry Association, recently went public about how his bank account was shut down, just, you know, for an operating account for him and his clients.
Oh, because he focused specifically on that industry. Wow.
My PAC account I had one PAC account, but then when I tried to change banks, they wouldn't give me a bank account, even for a political action committee that was going to support a marijuana measure. So, I mean, it's...
Meaning, like, you went to a
bank? Yeah,
changed your average bank.
Yeah, and they wouldn't even open an account for a political action committee. No marijuana money going in, just money to support, you know, changing
the law. Just because that was the topic.
Well, it seems... from their point of view, you're laundering money from an illegal drug operation into something else. Now, it could be for legitimate political activities, but from their standpoint, they have a pretty clear, problem on their hands. Now, that said, it's not like anybody, like they're not doing laundering on a mass scale. You can look at any of the, what was it, Royal Bank of Scotland or the huge kind of money laundering that was going on for drug dealing operations in South America. But when it actually comes up to the businesses that are, you know, maybe heavy licensed from the state or a use permit from the localities, they still are, because they're being open and notorious and trying to act like any other business, it makes them easier to be able to close their accounts.
Yeah. It's a shame, too. I mean, if they really wanted to be able to oversee the money and to control it and to make sure that everything is being accounted for, they'd give us bank accounts, because it's easier to hide money and not be out in the open with things if it's, you know, all done in cash. So it would suit the government better to actually give us the bank accounts.
Yeah, definitely. And probably a lot easier. also under the fact that it's not federally legal, employment is a little iffy, because I didn't even know this until recently. But so let's say, first of all, related to medical marijuana patients, let's say if I use some type of cannabis for fibromyalgia, I can still, that's still a fireable offense, mm-hmm. right? In for any employer in the state of California, even yeah. though it's
And they're relying on that federal legality. So yeah. I think a good case out of this to look at would be what happened in Colorado. A DirecTV fired a guy with MS who was using cannabis off time, you know, completely medical reason. And they're pretty obviously trying to get rid of him because, high medical costs that they were responsible for. And so he sued under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And they found, I believe it went all the way to the Ninth Circuit. And they said, no, it doesn't apply because the Americans with Disabilities Act is a federal protection. You don't have that.
Yeah. And it all same thing happened in California. We had a case, Raging Wire, went all the way to the Supreme Court in California. They said if the state wanted you to have that protection, they would have written that in the law. And then we went and had that introduced to the legislature. It went all the way to the governor in 1 year, cleared both houses. And then the governor said no. Schwarzenegger said no. California isn't ready to give workers protection for marijuana. So that's a shame. And we almost had it.
And even in 64, it explicitly, one of the ways that they marketed it to people is saying that we are not going to change.
You can still fire people.
We're not going to change the employer relationship. Employers have so much, and that dates back to who's the guy from, I should know this, I'm a huge Celtics fan, but the guy who died from the cocaine overdose in the, Len Bias. Ever since Len Bias, we've allowed employers to be able to P-test anybody for almost any reason. You have no ability to, very, 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 unless you're a union that's negotiated a contract that specifies that.
Yeah.
The idea of a drug-free workplace is used as a way of forcing employees for any reason to be able to submit to drug screening. Yeah. And especially for issues of workers' compensation, that's not going to change.
I know people that have gotten hurt at work and they're like, I'm not going to say anything about it because if I do, they're going to P-test me because I got hurt at work. I'm going to lose my job. It's sad. This is actually one of the issues that California Normal, our state chapter, wants to take up. And we're going to have a lobby day here in a couple months probably. Worker protection and also pain patients' bill mm-hmm. of rights, because some doctors – off subject, can still make someone choose between medical marijuana and pain pills. So those two issues are two big fundamental issues for people using cannabis in California, the employment and pain patients, right?
Wait, what you said about choosing between medical marijuana and pain pills, they can.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And they do sometimes.
Gotcha. They can't.
Because if you're getting pain medicine from them, they want to make sure that you're not using it or abusing it, not taking it, selling it to someone else. So they'll normally urine drug screen all their pain patients. And so if they find marijuana in their system, they'll say, some of them will be like, you need to choose. You can either get the marijuana or you can get the pain pills from me.
And the VA does this as a matter of policy.
Yeah. So and Kaiser has started doing it lately too. I've been hearing some Kaiser cases. So it's sad. There's people on some pain medicines where you can't just cut someone off cold turkey, but then also they found that this is such a great benefit to them that it's a really sad choice for people to have to make,
Yeah. Wow. That's something I hadn't even ever thought of. Related to employment, it is kind of crazy to think about, say if I'm a medical marijuana patient and I get the fact of wanting your workers to come with the, clear mind, whatever, depending, especially if you're in, handling big machinery. Like I get that, but it is interesting because say if you have a job where you are handling big machinery and you had, a beer on Friday night, you come on Monday, it's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's one of the.
Unless you had too much beer, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's probably one of the problems with your analysis as a means to be able to judge intoxication. The inactive compounds from cannabis use are going to be, especially if you're a stocky person with a lot of fat for it to be stored, and it's going to be around for a while.
Yeah, a couple months it'll stay in your system, so you will be long not high, and it'll still show that you are.
Versus other drugs like cocaine or even opiates, which only have a couple days and you can clear a drug screen.
And it's very interesting because my dad works for United Airlines and he has rheumatoid arthritis, but he's clear to take all the prescription pain drugs he wants and go work on airplanes. But God forbid he use cannabis on like a month vacation that he has and go back to work. That is not okay. Even with, a couple weeks in between, It's interesting how, our society looks at it and doesn't look at the real dangers,
Yeah, that. Do you suspect that that will be something California related to being able to judge the amount of cannabis in your system, like related to like impaired driving, or you know what I mean? Yeah. Is that something that California?
Well, one of the main proponents for, you know, and having to do a criminal defense, I mean, your main, the main point of when people get in trouble is driving. You know, and impaired driving, nobody wants to endorse that under any circumstances, but. You know, we have to, and I think any criminal defense lawyer who's been practicing in this will say that, yeah, there's a lot of jurisdictions out there that have been using DUIs as a means to either do discriminatory policing or, frankly, as a means to be able to fatten up their city coffers instead of doing actual progressive taxation. So, especially with weed DUIs, it's a very tricky, and it's very it's been overly permissive in the courts already, and now they're trying to establish this bright line stance where they have a nanogram count, which is entirely scientifically invalid.
What's a nanogram count?
So they want to be able to put a bright line thing kind of like similar to alcohol, where they alcohol, blood alcohol content, where you say 0.08, that is somebody who is drunk.
Yeah.
Now, frankly, hey, I have a ridiculously low alcohol tolerance. So if I have two drinks, I should not be behind the wheel under any circumstances. I know that by myself. But, you know, I only have 0.04 on my list, so I'm allowed to drive as far as I want. It's not a very scientifically valid or even public safety, you know, or under issue of trying to protect public safety, effective way of preventing impaired driving. If we train police to be able to look for actual signs of impaired driving, you know, talk about in the search warrants, when you I stopped this person because they shifted lanes, you know, I stopped this person because I actively smelled alcohol in their breath, you know, I saw remnants of alcohol or, you know, marijuana within the context of their car. All those things are really good ways of being able to point towards impairment. But instead, what they're focusing on are weird characteristics that called drug recognition elements. And so if you look at it, green tongue is still on the
list. Actually say that when you smoke marijuana, you get a green tongue. Totally
green tongue.
False.
Yeah.
Totally crazy. But they cite it over and over
law
again.
Law enforcement has to look for that?
No. They say if you're high, you have a green tongue.
And law enforcement will cite when you're brought up on a weed DUI saying, hey, you know, this person, I observed a green tongue when stopping them and doing
a green tongue.
Yeah,
green
tongue. Crazy, right? I've heard it for 10 years.
So what happens is that, you know, from the perspective of the people who are being pulled over, the only people who are going to survive weed DUIs from a criminal defense standpoint are the people who, A, don't say anything to the police and refuse an FST. But then on top of that are people who can afford an expert to come in and say, this is exactly where the police violated their own search and seizure rules. Yeah. This is where they got their drug recognition.
What else do police look for?
Like red eyes, dry mouth,
they make people do the literal song and dance when they're walking in between a line, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, and they're all, and if you look back at the scientific, I don't think that they have, and the courts have allowed them to do this, but they shouldn't pass any sort of good scientific test.
You know, I have heard from another attorney that you don't actually have to do field sobriety tests.
You do not.
Under any condition, marijuana or alcohol, you are not required to do the field sobriety test. That only adds ammo to their case against you because it gives them variables to say he failed this, he failed that. And often those tests are made so that almost everyone could fail them under someone's perspective, you know?
Police will do the FSTs outside of the view of a camera. I mean, they're pretty tricky about it. It's a means to be able to get a charge. They're trying to find a charge on you.
Yeah.
So my bosses at the Paw Brothers of Law would just tell people, you know, the best rule with the police is not to say them.
Yeah, zip it. And then also never even say, I smoked today. Don't even admit to smoking that day because that could still be a DUI. You know, if the officer says, do you smoke today? No, a couple days ago, you know, is the right answer. You know, but never say you did it that day.
From a law enforcement perspective, say, you know, I'm part of the LAPD. How are they addressing this? Like, what are they telling the officers? They're saying, hey, look for these things, because obviously that is, you know, you don't want someone to be behind the wheel on the road.
They're telling people still to look for the smell of cannabis, which, you know, I welcome them to do that because we have the case law on there that I think if we get a good motion and a good case behind it, we can actually take a lot of legal states have now taken away the smell of cannabis as a means for probable cause to be able to get a search warrant. So that's That's something that their training is unfortunately very far behind. And I think it's a result of this kind of abstinence-only education, drug education.
Gotcha. Their unwillingness to recognize anything.
The younger police officers actually are frankly a little bit more, because they've lived, now that we've had this law since 1996.
Some of them even have smoked. They now allow officers to have smoked for those couple of years ago and still.
So they, you know, we have a generation of police who have a little bit more of a practical sense of what this actually means. But they're the people who were designing the protocols for their training are still stuck in the 1970s, and it's still reefer madness. The current the current sheriff, Jim McDonald, when he was police chief of the city of Long Beach, I remember him testifying to our council all the time, and I had to tell my boss, this guy's straight up lying. He's either lying or he is terribly ignorant as to what the actual science and efficacy is behind what he's saying.
I was reading about a mouth swab test. Mm-hmm. Are you guys familiar with that?
They're trying to find any possible, device
like
to be able
thing
to get
that. They can use in the field.
The mouth swab right now is, you don't have to take it, correct, Stefan? You can say no to that test. What they're trying to do is they're trying to find people that they believe are driving under the influence, mouth swab them, bring them back to the station, take blood or urine, and then try to match it up so they can later qualify the mouth swab as accurate. So then they'll have cases to say, we arrested 1,000 people and they tested positive mouth swab, tested positive on urine, therefore our device is accurate. You know, that's what they're trying to create. So that's why people should say no.
Yeah.
You know, these devices and everything else that they're trying to develop, I mean, until they actually pass the standards for being allowed into evidence, you know, they will be very expensive boondoggles for the departments and jurisdictions that buy into them. So they caught an mTOR on their part.
What I was reading, I think it was somewhere maybe in San Diego where they were implementing the mouth swab, and it sounded expensive. I forget the specific amount that I think it was gifted to this particular department, but
cops love toys. You know, and the city managers especially, you'll see contracts for, and I saw this in the city of Long Beach, when defense manufacturers or anything else, when they're approaching local law enforcement, they'll sometimes do is give you the first year for free, but you're signing into a 3-year contract, so it's with the implied idea that you're going to be signing off for those next 2 years.
When it comes to you guys both, before we started recording, you guys said you both have kids. Mm-hmm. Little ones. How do you feel like you'll talk about, because something that has come up in our conversation, it comes up all the time, is it's still a Schedule I drug. The government considers it a drug. Mm-hmm. So when you're a little kid and you get told, don't do certain things, those are bad. If you hear mixed messages about cannabis, like how do you guys explain this or plan to explain this kind of topic to your kids?
Well, I think it's going to be kind of easier for us, maybe because my child's going to grow up around it, so he's going to grow up knowing that, where I've seen other parents struggle with what to do now because it's been hidden for so long, you know. There's some good books out there. There's one called It's Just a Plant. It's a children's book. It's a book that you can read with your child to kind of introduce the topic and how, you know, it's just the same as any other adult substance, you know, like, you know, that you keep away from your children. It's hard to say, you know, it just is integrated every day into life, and, you know, everything is kept away, and, you know, and he knows that thing, you know, don't go in the garage or don't go outside, you know, it's an adult time. But I think the thing I worry about the most is kind of talking to other kids' parents. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm the most apprehensive of, is when my child is 4 or 5 and he wants the kids to start coming over.
Yeah.
That's what I'm apprehensive about.
Before I got in working in cannabis, I was being trained for children's rights and parents' rights specifically. So I was really sensitive to that when I was first starting to go into it, and found out that, like with worker protections, there were very, very, very few parent protections. So, you know, keeping my child in my own custody while maintaining my status as a cannabis user and cannabis patient was really important. And what that's meant is that even though, you know, I'm well over the age of 21, you know, I keep my cannabis in a locked toolbox, you know, just so that I can be able to show a child welfare officer if that, God forbid, that ever happened. No, I've taken these necessary precautions. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what I then have to do at the same time is tell my child that something that, you know, I'm literally locking is not something that will kill them. And I think that's a necessary, that's something that was missing from, because I was born in 86, and so I was coming of age during the, you know, the day, the part where everybody kind of was acknowledging that DARE was useless. Yeah. And that idea of abstinence only when it comes to drugs is really not productive. You know, right now we've allowed, unfortunately, you know, because of this idea that drugs are something that you never have to touch and you never under any circumstances have any medical utility, for example, The knowledge and everything that's pursuant to that is being passed along anecdotally instead of from kind of more institutional sources. So it's up to people like parents like myself now to fill that void and say, look, you know, what you're being unfortunately taught in school is not necessarily, you know, scientifically accurate. I would prefer...
That's so confusing, right?
And I would prefer, and, you know, coming in, my big thing growing up in the early aughts and going to college then was binge drinking. Mm-hmm. So I'd rather my kid be very, very aware of the dangers of alcohol.
Responsible use.
And the socialization regarding alcohol. You know, cannabis, be aware of it, and if you have problematic use, then absolutely, it's an issue. But at the same time, any sort of drug use needs to be, you know, taken under serious consideration as to the long-term consequences with your health.
Yeah, they need to teach responsible use to everything to kids. I mean, you can overspend, you can get addicted to love, to relationships.
You can open 6 credit cards.
Yeah, you know, like responsible use needs to be taught in schools, and it needs to be integrated with everything, you know?
Yeah, so kind of maybe like you would talk to your kids about, hey, listen, when you go to college, there's going to be a lot of liquor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Careful with that.
Yeah. Just everybody's going to be curious, but just so you know, yeah, exactly. Talk about, you know, consequences and smart decisions.
And frankly, it's a good way to be able to talk about consequences as something that's not necessarily indicative with the. It's really good right now as a way of showing that, you know, the state necessarily isn't necessarily the all good. You know, it's a good way of teaching kids that. Punishment can come without actual, could be outsized and not proportional to the actual harm that you were causing.
Yeah, maybe a good lesson, life lesson for them, huh? Mm-hmm.
Definitely. So I want to get you guys out of here. I'm sure you have a lot to do today, but basically, what's next? What are you focusing on this year?
I got to get my, actually, we're both today getting renewals for our cards.
Yeah.
We weren't even planning on
that. Get out of that tax. For 2018, Normal, our chapter of Normal, is going to concentrate on a Start Low, Go Slow campaign for the new adult use users. Gotcha. A lot of people, they see, oh, 10 milligrams, or I can get this whole bar of 100 milligrams, and it's really yummy. I'm going to eat the whole thing. We're trying to get the word out that a good starting dose is 2.5 to 5 milligrams, you know, that the effect does take a couple hours. And thirdly, do not mix with alcohol for those new users. So we're going to incorporate an adult appealing turtle symbol, not appealing to children because that's part of the regulations, and really try to get the word out, get some of these licensed dispensaries to chip in money, hopefully get some bus benches, some flyers, stickers, all that kind of thing to get the word out. That's something that the state really took up in Colorado, but I've not seen anything from the Bureau about any kind of educational campaign in California.
Yeah, it seems like that would be super beneficial.
Yeah, like some kind of commercials, like don't, in Colorado, they say, don't ruin your whole vacation for a brownie. That's like their campaign.
Oh.
You know, so something similar should be done in California for tourists.
Yeah, I've seen, we have a commercial on our channel that's various medical marijuana patients talking about why they use it, how it helps them, but I don't drive.
Oh, good.
It's basically a PSA talking about don't
That's
drive
wonderful.
Impaired.
Exactly.
But definitely the go low and slow. Is that what you said? Go low and slow. That is probably
start low, go slow.
Because there's going to be so many people who maybe haven't.
Yeah, and
maybe
they don't
they're
know.
Curious. They're like, oh,
a
now
cookie.
It's legal.
They
let's try it.
They can't. They don't understand how strong a cookie can be.
And a lot of baby boomers who haven't smoked things that have actually been grown not just for being able to shove into a brick, but actually being grown for taste or for its effectiveness. And so you have people who are not. You know, people talk about the you know, super THC levels. I don't necessarily think that's necessarily true, but you know the amount of plant material that you need to actually consume to have that effect is a lot different than it was in the 1970s.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So people will jump in at their old level and be in over their heads.
Right, because it's stronger now.
Or they haven't used it for such a long time that their tolerance is completely at a naive user's level.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Gotcha. What about you, Stefan, 2018?
2018 for me is just making sure that, you know, my revenge over the city of Long Beach is continuing. I love saying it on the planning department and all of the fourth floor now are cannabis applicants. You know, I want to be able to paint my town green, the industrial zones, any of these places like that. We have unlimited cultivation, unlimited manufacturing.
They could use the money there.
With a 6% tax going back to the city. So, you know, I want to displace oil, and I want to displace the port as the primary economic vehicle for our city.
Nice.
You're the cannabis crusader of Long Beach.
Yeah.
Stefan.
You heard it here.
I love it. Thank you for listening to the Olympic and Bundy podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please leave a rating and review. Subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher if you haven't already to get new episodes automatically downloaded to your phone as they come out. Fox 11 reporter Hal Eisner is going to have an in-depth show, a 30-minute show dedicated to the whole topic of marijuana, all different things related to this, coming up in, I believe, the end of January. So look for that. I'm Kelly Taylor, and thanks again for listening.